Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and this is tape number 488, broadcast number 488, April the 12th, 1981. I have a guest with me this evening, Ray Fabrizio, professor for Monterey Peninsula College, an accomplished musician here on the Monterey Peninsula, who has time to teach and to do his music and also to study current events constantly and turn the students on to what's happening. I've been very lucky on this peninsula. I've been able to express my opinions and research for 9 years at KLRB, and I've been lucky also two semesters Ray and I taught a class at Monterey Peninsula College on the American assassinations, and thanks to Ray and his constant working with young people, we've been able to reach people in this community who've gone over other places elsewhere, and a lot that he's done has reached many, many people. Before I introduce you to Ray, I just want to say I have a book that I really like very much, and it has a list of ways to make life rich and full of meaning. And I was looking at it this week, and I was thinking it describes Ray Fabrizio and the relationship that he has with his research, or that I've known him. It was a book on creative thinking, and the first item was a desire to make things better, alertness to be open to everything, an interest in digging below the surface, curiosity, a constant spirit of inquiry, thoughtfulness leading to thorough understanding, concentration to penetrate matters in depth, the application of your energy and effort, patience to solve problems in detail, optimism, combining enthusiasm and self-confidence, and cooperation, working productively with others. I think those 10 things are very important for the people that I like and respect, and Ray is one of those people. It's really been wonderful knowing you and working with you on this peninsula and sharing information constantly.
Well, thanks, Mia. Gosh, I hope that I have just a few of those qualities that you mentioned, and I think I have also I don't know about the depth. I spread myself so thin. I do have the interest and the awareness, but unfortunately, I don't have the time to devote to these things that I would like to have.
I think you have the depth. I think throwing out new ideas every time there is a holiday, a remembrance of John Kennedy's assassination or the shooting of John Lennon, or this evening we're going to talk about the near murder or the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan and the comparisons to the John Kennedy assassination, just alerting people to the possibility that there are similarities and sharing them with your students. They always come back, and I hear from them that you're opening up new doors and areas that other people are afraid to do. They're afraid to go into it, and you bring out the possibility, is there more than we're seeing? And that is important. You don't have to tell them what they'll find at the end of the tunnel, but at least tell them to explore it.
Exactly, and I do try to give them hints on how to detect propaganda and how to know when they're being lied to, and then they can be on their own. This is very important, and they need the encouragement to know that someone older with more experience has the same kinds of doubts and questions, and they shouldn't be afraid to doubt and question themselves.
This is
my job as a teacher, I think.
Well, last week when the shooting took place of Ronald Reagan, I got a phone call from a gentleman on the peninsula who is retired now. He's in the highest levels of military intelligence and in the Army. He was the interpreter at the Gary Powers trial. Peter Thomas, do you know him? He lives on the peninsula.
I know of him.
Yeah, and he's a close friend of mine, and he interpreted for Khrushchev and for Gary Powers, speaks Russian, German, and English. And he was talking about the Reagan shooting, and he believes in the research that we're doing. He said the truth will set you free. He's not afraid of truth coming out. And I said, well, what will we do when another layer of cover-up comes? And he said, do what you're doing. Reach the young people and keep telling them the truth. And eventually, forget about the older ones and get to the young people so they can see it. And that's what you do at the college. I hear all the time from the different classes.
Well, I hope I hope I reach a few. I know you do. A lot of my students listen to your show regularly.
Well, I have one apology now, and then we're going to go on to this evening. It's going to be the comparisons of patterns between the murder of John Kennedy specifically and the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. I have to apologize to my listeners. Last week, a play of words and kind of a little joke, I kept talking about John Warlock Hinkle.
Warlock, right.
Warlock Hinkle. Well, there was one article in the paper that he got a job as a disc jockey at a station using the name Warlock. And I did it half as a joke, knowing that the Warlock would link eventually to the Manson family and the whole cast of Lies. And the Hinkley remind me of Warren Hinkle, a double agent in San Francisco, who I detest. So it was kind of an in-joke. Warlock Hinkle. And then this week, this clone, this Edward Richardson, appeared in New Haven, Connecticut, in New York, who was in the nearby area of Colorado, whose paths crossed with Hinkley, John Hinkley. And he said his hero was the Manson family and Squeaky Fromm and the SLA, so, and that we have a whole team of assassins, and his mentor is Carl McIntyre and the Deep Christian Church. So I knew within a week the Warlock would tie in. The whole mystical thing would go in. Too long to cover now, and I won't do any more in-jokes. We'll call him John Hinckley Jr.,
right.
But I still want to call him Warlock. Okay? Now, on to the gross similarities. What are the ones, some of those that you notice that people, young people or older people, should be noticing in this case?
Well, I noticed right from the beginning, from the earliest videotapes, that there was a lot of contradiction between what I saw and what the press was explaining that I saw. For example, the shots. The three men who were hit react violently to shots, and yet we see the president being pushed into the car. And I've studied the videotapes quite closely, and I'm going to get 5 more hours of them by next week, which I'll study even more closely. But I'm convinced that Reagan was not hit. If he was hit, it was by a very different kind of bullet. Or if he was hit, he was hit after he got into the car. The reason why I say that is that we can see McCarthy, the Secret Service man, being literally lifted off his feet by one of the shots. We can see, of course, the police officer and Brady are felled immediately. And to lift a 179-pound man, McCarthy, off the ground requires a high-powered rifle. And also, he was thrown, I would say 5 to 6 feet to our right. That is, from the view of the camera, he's thrown right. I would say 5 or 6 feet. That would be consistent with a shot from
somewhere
our left, from somewhere else, where everybody, by the way, was looking as soon as the shots rang
out. Somewhere else.
All the eyes are in that direction, and then Hinckley is back here where the camera is. Now, that's an indication of more than the possibility of shots from more than one direction.
Different. Also, and for those of the listeners who are too young or don't remember the Dallas comparison, when John Kennedy was shot through the throat or through the back, or John Connally, they were fairly clean bullets. And then his head exploded and the brain crashed, and that was messy. In this case, three men were messy, and Reagan was clean.
Was
the
clean.
Response was totally different.
That's right.
Coming from one gun.
And we have shots coming from the rear. The shot that went through Connally is definitely from the rear.
It was a clean bullet, though.
That was a clean bullet.
Came out pristine. It was so clean.
That's right.
Yeah. But the response of Reagan, the first story was that he walks into the hospital on his own feet or was just thrown to the car for protection. And the reaction of Ronald Reagan was entirely different than the other three men.
That's true. Exactly.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, you know, the photos are so important, I think, in both assassinations, JFK and the assassination attempt on President Reagan. I'm interested in the photos that must exist that were taken by newsmen standing next to the car and behind the car, photographing from the, in other words, photographing the whole action from the opposite point of view. In other words, Hinckley would be in these photographs.
They said they would show us those, but they never did.
They haven't yet.
They said they would.
And that should solve any doubts about Hinckley and his friend there. I'm sure you'll mention it.
Yeah, we'll get it. Well, that is consistent with the Warren Commission using and confiscating immediately the film of Abraham Zapruder standing on the side of the car where John Kennedy was hit from the one side. And then individual researchers, such as Richard Sprague, collecting 25,000 different photos or feet of pictures across the street where there is possibly a gunman or a man standing at the Daltex window on the stepway, and a Mr. Hicks of the security department picking up shells. And the view was entirely different from the other side you might have gotten in researchers through the years, including the tramps being taken away and so forth. The Zapruder film only caught the fact that the president was killed.
That's right. And if these, of course, this kind of withholding of vital evidence, if these films were, if people were interested, if the FBI were really interested in solving these crimes, all they need to do is collect these photographs, and by triangulating them, we would know exactly which shots were fired and as we can reconstruct now in Dealey Plaza.
Of course, that's another comparison. You have that quotation I gave you of the FBI. You say, if they were interested, and yet, for all purposes, the case was solved, you know, within
that's
3 days.
They said that we've got, there he is.
Yeah, we've got the case for all, we have no evidence of a conspiracy, the FBI said. We have some sheets here. You'll hear papers rattling with a description of the FBI will come across them saying, for all purposes, nobody else was involved.
Right.
The men investigating the case and the Justice Department.
Another important parallel that I see is another parallel is the importance of eyewitnesses interviewed on the scene right after the events. Yeah. You'll recall the eyewitnesses at Dealey Plaza in Dallas spoke of shots coming from the grassy knoll. I mean, the overwhelming majority of them. Other eyewitnesses heard shots from other directions, too. And yet the Warren Commission chose to believe that all the shots came from the one... from the one man again. Now, eyewitnesses, when Reagan's... when the shots were fired at Reagan, first said that they did not see Reagan hit. They also the reports for an hour, I believe, were that the president had not been hit. Now, I think these eyewitness accounts are very interesting. Later on in the day, when these same videotapes were being replayed, the eyewitness remarks were cut out of the tapes.
Well, it's the original tapes, though, whoever videotaped it right away got
those.
Even got a reference to the grassy knoll.
That's right.
They
somebody
pointed to the wall that. And said they came from the grassy knoll.
I think somebody was trying to be funny, but it had real relevance.
Yeah.
Because one of the eyewitnesses spoke of seeing someone shooting from up there. There was some reference to a higher shot.
Yeah.
And also...
Sherman Skolnick said that I talked to him today. He's a well-known researcher in Chicago, and he said that one of the witnesses, who hasn't been interviewed since then, a woman, and it wasn't Judy Woodruff, you know, who was staying near the NBC camera. It was somebody that said they heard a crackling fire and suggested even the roof, the trajectory of higher up at the Hilton Hotel, that there was this sound coming from a crackling noise that they picked up, and this person has never been located.
Hmm.
And also...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I remember distinctly in one of the early videotapings, there was a young eyewitness, a young man, who was asked by one of the reporters, did you see the president hit? And he said, no, I didn't see him hit. When the shots rang out and when he was being pushed in the car, I could see that his face showed concern and that he was startled. And then he started to say more, but there was a fellow, a very imposing, tall and strong fellow behind him, happened to be a black man, who looked sort of hippie-ish, but you knew he wasn't. He was, and in a voice of quiet authority, he said, hold up, man. Now hold up there.
Didn't want him to talk?
Didn't want him to talk. And the young man turned around quite know.
Did you get on the tape?
This is on the tape.
On the videotape.
Well, this will undoubtedly be on the 5 hours of tape that I'm going to get from a friend next time, but I distinctly remember that.
Now, the changing of the trajectory of the bullets, one gun expert told me that in order to try and kill somebody, you aim for the arm or armpit because it can go down to the heart if it's higher up, and if they wear a bulletproof vest, you're sure to get them. You go for the armpit and it goes down. Now, if there were somebody, again, on a roof, maybe with a silencer, with that crackling sound, simultaneously, and his arm is raised, that would explain how
it
went 1 inch from the heart and went in the armpit.
That's right. That would explain. However, this would have had to happen pretty much as Reagan was pushed into the car, because as he is pushed into the car, he shows no sign of being hit by any high-powered rifle.
Until he gets in the car.
Well, we know that when he got in the car, he complained
that the
Secret Service Agent Parr, is that his name?
This is something we were talking about that isn't a comparison to Kennedy, because he was good and dead. Interesting point is that, like you're saying, Ronald Reagan fell down and blamed the agent for breaking his rib, which would be similar to the Robert Kennedy assassination, say, if he had lived where Thane Caesar is behind him and shoots from behind, if he wasn't 1 inch from the back of the head, say the shoulder hit, where they later removed the ceiling from the ambassador and cut off the sleeve that where the shots came from behind. Was Ronald Reagan in the car? And that anguish on his face is that he got a bullet into the area and collapsed and blamed his fall on cracking a rib.
In any case, Reagan's wound is not consistent with a shot fired from ground level. It's not consistent with a shot fired because he was pushed into the car, and as he's bending down, the shot would go up, right? All of the diagrams showing Reagan's wound show a very, very clean wound angling down from his armpit.
And then it changes
off
course.
Off the rib, and then it lodges in the lung. Well,
This is like the Dallas story again. These bullets do the zigzags. They don't just go down. They ricochet. They change course. They go back up, and then they go down again.
Here's another parallel. The changing of the evidence with regard to wounds. The nature of the wounds are very important in any murder case.
And the very first day, you get an exact diagram.
Yes.
Of the bullet and the wound.
Now, they say it's a ricochet. Of course, we'll talk about that, I guess, in a minute, why they had to have six shots. But a ricochet bullet becomes very deformed, and it doesn't follow a neat path in any body.
So for the time it hits, then it breaks, you mean?
That's right. It's very difficult for me to buy the story that Reagan was hit by a ricochet bullet. But the ricochet bullet story, to me, must be an attempt to restrict the bullets to six, because if we got another bullet, we've got a conspiracy. Political conspiracies don't happen in this country, right? They only happen in the Banana Republic.
Well, of course, the photographing of this scene and the photographing of Dallas are the same, and then the one you had to fit the amount of bullets into the Mannlicher Carcano in the certain amount of seconds that the film was going. And in this case, you can't have more than six, so you have to, if you have seven bullets, one of them has to be not from where John Hinckley was standing, but from the car, which is a different direction, isn't it?
That's right, or from the front of the car. I counted the bullets. Now, at first they said that the police officer was hit by two bullets.
Uh-huh.
But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say he was hit by one bullet, which injured his shoulder and his neck. All right, we've got McCarthy, the Secret Service man, hit once.
Yeah.
We've got the police officer, Delaney, I believe.
Uh-huh.
He's hit once. We've got Brady hit once. We've got Reagan hit once.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the door
twice.
Hit once. We've got the window hit once. And we've got a hole in the building across the street, which I thought was a bank, but you said might
be different. Well, it would be an insurance company or a bank,
Now, that's seven.
Uh-huh.
That's even granting them one shot to the police officer.
In 3 seconds.
In
less than 3 seconds, almost.
Yeah, I didn't
yeah,
I didn't
the
know
timing
that,
was actually less than 3 seconds.
No.
Mm-hmm. And three were felled to the ground, and the other one is singing and dancing and wishing he was in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
With blood coming out of his nose and mouth.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's another parallel. The contradictory reports about the president's reactions to his wound.
Well, the very first confusion was so obvious when they said it was a .38 caliber. This is on the tapes.
Right.
And then it became a .22. Well, the minute John Kennedy was put into Parkland Hospital and Lee Harvey Oswald became the suspect, they were walking out of the building with a Mannlicher, with the German Mauser.
German Mauser.
And identified by the law enforcement. And that took them 24 hours to become a Mannlicher Carcano.
That's right.
Now, this Hinckley, they jumped the gun on two things. Just like with Lee Harvey Oswald, they said it was the German Mauser. And there were Mausers in the building.
That's right.
Remember, there were two Mausers in the building?
In a different spot, though.
Yeah. Oswald, when he was arrested, said, wait, there's Mausers in the building. Then it became a Carcano. Well, in this case, he had bought a .38, one in Dallas. It was confiscated in Nashville. And then he bought a .38 in Denver, Colorado, on January 21st of this year. So right away, they said it was a .38. And then all of a sudden, they said, no, it's a .22, because he bought that from poor old Mr. Goldstein. We'll get into that. And it became a .22. But where did they get the confusion again about the nature of the bullets, or 3 days later saying that they're hollow bullets?
That they're hollow bullets or explosive. And that was another fuzzy thing, the difference between explosive bullets and hollow head poison-filled bullets with poison cartridges. And, you know, going back to the Mauser and Carcano, maybe our listeners maybe they don't understand that the German Mauser rifle is generally considered by experts in firearms to be one of the most deadly and deadly accurate weapons for any kind of killing. And the Italian Carcano is universally recognized as the worst. It's completely outdated. So we're not talking about just an unimportant point here. In other words, if a .38 was used, we might be able to explain the force of the missile that hit McCarthy.
Totally different.
Totally different.
The
from
three
a
of them, yes, and then the yes. one little .22.
Right. This is a parallel which is very important because the hard evidence, the ballistics evidence, is so essential. And of course, the ballistics evidence was messed up and messed with very early on in the Kennedy assassination.
So what we get is a difference in what the weapon was, a difference in the direction, a discrepancy on how many could go out in a given time. The witnesses that had one version that are never called to present themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing you're getting in this case is the silence of the surgeons you mentioned.
Yes, to this moment, they've never been interviewed.
Never been seen. They're not going to go on a limb like Commander Hume and say it went this way or that way.
All of the doctors at Parkland Hospital, for example, for I think it was a day and a half, said that the first shot that hit Kennedy in the neck was an entrance
uh-huh.
shot. Well, after the FBI interviewed them, then it suddenly became an exit wound, you know. And then it makes these doctors look silly. So I can appreciate the fact that they might not want to go out on a limb describing describing the real operation that was performed
years.
On our president now.
One of the points of the comparisons that I made note is that at the time that John Kennedy was killed, the Secret Service and all the people made a run in a different direction than when Lee Harvey Oswald was. And in this case, everyone was looking in a different place than where
right.
John Hinckley.
They were looking straight ahead, and Hinckley was to their left.
Up to the left,
that's
yes.
Right. And also, well, yeah, finish.
No, go on, that's okay.
I'm, you know, there's so much to talk about.
We could do 3 hours.
But I find it very suspicious. There's another parallel here. I found it suspicious that the president had to walk so far to the limousine from this exit that the car was not parked directly in front of the exit, which seems to me to be the safest thing to do.
He had to make a slant.
He had to turn, yes, he had to walk quite a ways, and the car was at a weird slant, right at the curve of that
uh-huh.
drive. Now, in the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination, we see very clearly that the presidential limousine slows down as they approach. It almost stops when it gets to the grassy knoll area.
Uh-huh.
And these are very suspicious things.
They didn't escalate till after he was hit.
Until
and in this
the
case,
shots.
They had him walking farther at an angle, which would be really difficult. I also think if he was walking straight from the door to the car, probably through the arm or something, there'd be less chance of getting the heart. At the angle that he was at, he was more at an angle where it'd be easier to get him.
Well, I think the parallel in both cases, yeah, that's true. The parallel in both cases is that both moves put the president in greater danger, contrary to standard Secret Service procedure.
Yeah.
In other words, well, you get into the secret.
Well,
you've got a note there about the parallels, about the protecting of the president.
Yeah.
All of these rules that are violated, standard practices violated by the Secret Service in both instances.
The favors of law enforcement. Well, one of the shocking articles was in the Washington Post this week, April 3rd, where Mr. Knight, Director Stuart Knight of the Secret Service, said that this potential assassin was in the audience right on the street, a known potential assassin, well known to the Secret Service as a possible threat, was in the crowd of onlookers. And the diversionary in all of this was John. He was acting up, even though he was a known threat, and people were watching him, when it was John Hinckley who really was just standing there. And They didn't apprehend him or take him off the street. And Mr. Knight said the person that people thought was Hinckley, the acting like a herky-jerky manner he uses, I don't know where he gets that from, just before the shots rang out, was already a known person in the Secret Service, and they ascertained that he posed no threat. Well, was he ever frisked? If everybody is looking at the single hand going out, is that the only one that's shooting?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a posture to stick your hand straight out, you know, of this motley group and just throw away those bullets.
There was no question in my mind, looking at the videotapes, that hand was firing shots.
Oh, yes.
You can see the pistol recoil. But this business of he's the one, this propensity to think, to make us believe that when you find one man, you've solved a crime.
Well, that's like Sirhan Sirhan's attorney saying when it came out that there was evidence of a second gun. He said, well, being as my client was there with the intent to shoot, you know, he's guilty anyway. It doesn't matter, you know, with the intent. Sirhan could be a diversionary shooting around the place where the fatal bullet comes from behind, from a security guard. So what you get here is a situation where the security guards are all looking at one man and jumping him.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the herky-jerky guy go that was the risk?
That's right. And
well, did they run and grab him, too, if they a herky-jerky? I don't think Mr. Stuart Knight uses that often. He's making all the funny faces, and he's the diversionary. Did anyone run for him?
Obviously not.
Maybe he was holding the .38 that Hinckley got in. You know, who knows what the guys were hit from, and maybe Hinckley was working with somebody on the street. They all ran for the one person.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a real parallel. It's got to be a lone assassin. They come on the air immediately after all political assassinations in this country. Some authority comes on the air immediately, even before the facts are in, before all of the elementary facts are in, and they say no conspiracy.
Well, this is why I think Jack Ruby's murder of Lee Harvey Oswald was done on camera, because if you saw him shoot, somebody else wasn't holding his hand, and therefore there was no conspiracy. They don't go into the telephone call or really go to probe of how he knew what time Oswald comes through the basement or how he got into the basement. If you saw him shoot, therefore he did it alone. And if you see John Hinckley there, he did it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw his hand, didn't you?
You saw his hand, didn't you?
Time magazine and Newsweek, and they all have a story. This is the end of the first half hour. We're going to take a one-minute break. This goes too fast.
Already?
Isn't that terrible? We'll take a break. This is Mae Brussel and Ray Fabrizio and Carmel, and we'll be back with you in 1 minute.
World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.